Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 4, The Perfection of Viriya, Wise Effort, with Jack Kornfield.
The next in these series of teachings, they're talking about generosity and the generous heart and integrity and so forth, has to do with the quality of how to cultivate or discover or awaken wise effort or wise energy in practice so that we live fully and wisely. A part of what's interesting is to me, as I begin to reflect about this for our life, is that not only is it difficult to live, but it's even difficult to die. And I say this both having done a number of years of hospice work of different kinds, but in particular in the last couple of weeks, my wife's father, David, who is a very beautiful man at this point, he's 90 and it's kind of time. His body's falling apart in a whole variety of ways, and he was just in the hospital and they thought he might die, but he didn't, and now he's in a nursing home where he doesn't really want to be. He wants to go home. Of course, part of going home is not necessarily the house home, but the final going home, maybe. And then there's some ways where he says, I'm just ready. But I've been with a number of people who've been ready, and their body hasn't been ready. It has its own life to it. This dear friend who had cancer for a number of years and got weaker and weaker, finally it was time for her to die, and the whole community were around her and saying her last things and saying her goodbyes, and people were there around the clock and so forth. And it went on from week to week to week to week, you know, and she was lying there and everyone thinks she was dying and better hurry up and say your goodbyes. And then I came a couple weeks later, I'd been out of town, and there she was up reading the paper and paying the bills, and people were like saying, all right, so when are you going to die already? There's this tremendous force of life that we've been given with our birth to exist in this body. It's quite extraordinary. And so that's part of what I want to speak about tonight, that energy, vigor, aliveness, and what we do with that life power that's given to us. Now, as you recall, many of these teachings of the perfections of the heart, and wisdom and so forth, are carried by children's stories in India. And so a relevant story from the previous births of the Buddha, it said, once a long time ago when you were much younger than you are now, but not so much younger, the Buddha was born as a tiny little calf. A calf that would grow one day to be a great oxen. And this calf was given to a young but poor Brahmin family, farmer and his wife, a couple of children. As he grew bigger and bigger. He became this wonderful and magnificent creature, this great ox, who would pull the cart and pull the plow and so forth, and brought so much happiness into the lives of the family that he was named Great Joy. So the kids took the oxen out to the field, as kids do in Asia. He was cleaned and washed and pulled things and so forth. And one day, while the farmer, the Brahmin and his family were eating dinner, the ox wandered over to the hut and stuck his head in the window and said, you know, I've been thinking. And they were rather surprised because the oxen had never spoken to them before. He said, I see your circumstances are very, very poor. You know, and you just barely eke out a living. And I've thought of a way to help us all in this family. They were rather taken. So he said, this is the idea. Said, you go into the marketplace and say you have a magnificent ox. And they'll say, well, an ox is an ox, after all, a strong ox. Say, no, my ox could pull 100 carts all hooked together, filled with stone. No oxen has ever done that. And get them to bet whatever you can, 1,000 pieces of silver against your property and your land, and I'll pull it, and you'll be rich. So he went into town, sat in a coffee shop, said, "I have an ox." Everyone said, "Yeah, so do we. But I have a really strong ox." "Strong ox? That's what oxen are. They're strong. What's new?" Said, "No, no, my oxen can," etc., etc. And it was all set up. 1,000 pieces of silver. And the oxen went to the square, and carts were there, and everyone came out. And just as the time to begin was there, the Brahmin, with all the eyes focused on him, stepped closer to Great Joy, sighed, and then raised the stick and struck him sharply on the side and cried out, "You beast, on, you wretch, do as I say, pull these carts." Well, he'd never done that before. And when Great Joy felt the sting of the whip and heard these harsh words, his eyes opened wide and thought, "Now, what is this? Blows and curses? I'm trying to help him. I'm not moving," and dug his heels in. And everyone laughed because the ox wouldn't move. And not only didn't he not pull 100 carts, he didn't even try. All the money was lost. He lost most of his possessions, his face, everything was gone. He went back home, and he was so depressed about it. And then the oxen stuck his head into the window again. And he said, "You failed me," to the ox. "How could you?" And the oxen said, "Now let's talk about this. Who's failed whom?" Said, "What did I ever do to deserve your whipping and being called a beast and a wretch? I thought I was supposed to help you." And the Brahmin realized, oh, he'd gotten caught, as one does, in the stereotypes of the world. So the ox said, "Listen, let's do this one more time. Let's do it right." And so the whole scene was set up again. He borrowed money to bet, whatever, and people said, "This is really a fool. He lost almost everything the last time and he wants to do it again." But he did, and the oxen was hooked up, and this time he put a garland of flowers around its neck, and he pissed its face, and he said, "Oh, my great, beautiful ox, show them your magnificence." And the oxen strained and pulled, and you know the rest of the story. Rah! Slowly the wheels began to turn, and everyone said, "He's doing it, he's doing it." And in fact, 2,000 pieces of silver and great riches and happiness ever after, and so forth. Or so it's told. So you can hear in the beginning of this story, it's really a story about power. And what is our relationship to those who have power or to the power and energy ourselves? What is wise use of energy in spiritual life? It's spoken of often. One traditional way that it's spoken of, the effort of the heart, most traditionally, is to avoid or to release that which is unskillful. To take the effort or the energy to let go of addiction and greed and fear and hatred and anger, to see them and to say, "No, I release those." And on the opposite, to cultivate or to nourish or to awaken within ourselves that which is skillful. Clarity, balance, mindfulness, kindness, wisdom. People say, "Well, can you really do this? Can you make a choice?" And the Buddha responds, "Were it not possible to do so, I would not teach it. But it is possible, so you might try it." Like someone sitting at the foot of a tree and sorting through the apples or the mangoes that are there. These are ripe and beautiful ones to be saved, and these are rotten ones or worm-eaten ones. You begin to pay attention to the experience of life and see those things that lead down the road of fear, contraction, anger, hatred, and release those. Don't put them in your basket. And you see those moments and those states that lead to balance and clarity and compassion, and receive those and nourish them. In that sense, effort in spiritual practice or energy is the effort to pay attention and use what presents itself in our human life to serve ourselves and others, to awaken both compassion and a freedom of heart in all circumstances. Now, usually, effort is confused with some goal We set ourselves a goal and we climb the mountain or we build the building or we make the money or whatever that goal is that we have. But effort in spiritual practice is really different than that. It's not about a goal. Because we can't even really measure it in our normal ways. In fact, usually we don't know where we are spiritually. This is from Zen Master Dogen. He says, speaking of understanding, when you go out into the middle of the ocean looks round or circular and does not look any other way, does it? But the ocean is, in fact, neither round nor square, and its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular to our eyes from one perspective, from one moment. All things are like this. Although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite variety all around us. It is so in every moment, in the tiniest drop of water. So it looks a certain way, but we're not really sure. There was a man who the Buddha encountered at one point in his wanderings in India, a yogi who was standing on one leg. And this was his spiritual practice, all these kind of strange ascetic practices in India. And he was rooted to this spot, and he spent many hours a day standing on one leg, burning up, as he said, the bad karmas of the past by this kind of penance and austerity, and preparing himself then to lead a life of purity. And the Buddha came and said, how long have you been standing like this? And the man said, many years. And why do you do this? And he said, to burn up all my past karma and purify myself. And the Buddha said, well, how much more karma do you have to burn up? The man said, I don't know exactly. And then the Buddha said, well, how much karma have you burned up so far? The man said, well, I don't know exactly. And the Buddha said, well, how long do you think it will take to burn up this karma? The man said, well, actually, I don't know. And the Buddha said, what are you doing? And the man began to think about it. The effort, when we put it in terms of a goal, I'm going to finish my karma, I'm going to make myself this or that, just ties us in knots, really, doesn't it? Because we don't know. Things are always changing. Remember that saying from Einstein, where he said, if you sit on a sofa with a pretty girl, he said, 2 hours can feel like 2 minutes. But if you sit on a hot stove, 2 minutes can feel like 2 hours. That's relativity. Right? The idea isn't to get some goal in mind and now I've got this and that spiritual thing and that spiritual accomplishment. But the perfection of our energy or effort is that which allows us to be present. Here we are in this moment for what's beautiful and what's hot, like on the stove. The energy to be awake and see the world in its suchness, truthfully, for what it is. Someone said, maybe it was Woody Allen, half of life is just showing up, you know, or maybe it's more than that. But when one shows up with one's heart and eyes and mind all together, that quality of presence transforms everything. One kind word can warm 3 winter's months, says in Japanese proverbs. Just a moment of kindness can change everything. So the energy or the effort is that of presence in meditation, in your relationships, in work with our children. Now we've been conditioned to think it should be some special way. You know, our society conditions us so much that there are things to avoid and we should make ourselves as comfortable and safe as possible, and in our culture, certainly grief and conflict and racism and all kinds of things that are difficult, we kind of try to hide and not deal with. Make our lives safe. That's sort of the American instruction in some way. But you can't really, you know. And you can do things to care for yourself. I don't mean to be irresponsible. This is from Helen Keller. Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do children as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. I remember Vimla Thakkar, who is a wonderful teacher in India. She was telling us about when Krishnamurti first encouraged her to teach. She was sort of one of the Dharma successors to Krishnamurti. And his main advice to her was, don't be afraid to make mistakes. Just go and do it. A Zen master's life is one continuous mistake, it said, which is just one opportunity to learn after another. Or as Winston Churchill spoke of, he said, I've eaten many of my words, and I found them rather nourishing. So the wise effort of life in this way is really the invitation to live fully, to be present. Robert De Vincenzo, who was a famous Argentinian golfer, once won a tournament and after receiving the check, smiling for the cameras, went to the clubhouse prepared to leave. Sometime later, he walked to his car in the parking lot, was approached by a young woman who congratulated him on his victory and then told him a story about how her child was seriously ill and near death, and she didn't know how she'd pay the doctor bills and the hospital expenses. And he was very moved and took out the check he just won and endorsed it here and said, make some good days for the baby, and handed it to her, got in his car. The next week when he was having lunch at the country club, a certain official came over and said, some of the boys in the parking lot told me about the young woman you met after the tournament. Well, said the official, I have news for you. She's a phony. She has no sick baby. She's not even married. She fleeced you, my friend. You mean there's no baby who's dying, said De Vincenzo. That's right, said the official. That's the best news I've heard all week, he said. Ah. It's a different response, isn't it? So the quality of spiritual life is, as Helen Keller points out, one of adventure and the discovery of the capacity to bring a full heart to what we do. Think about it for a moment. How much of what we've done in our life is half-hearted? Different things that you've done, kind of just gotten through them. You know what I mean? And what it feels like as one reflects about those. And then remember the times that you've given yourself fully, really given your whole being and heart and energy to something, and how it feels when you remember that you've given yourself to. And usually in those cases, it doesn't even matter how it comes out. What matters is that we gave ourselves fully to it. Often we tend to think of the energy of spiritual life or love or whatever as kind of a battery that we have inside, this little battery, right? That we have to be careful or it will run down, right? And if we give too much of ourselves, we're afraid we'll run out. Do you know that model? Like there's only so much love or so much energy. It actually is the opposite. It's not like some little battery in there. As we give, we open ourselves. As we become full, it's as if we become a channel. And the more that we give or the more that we open, the more can come through. There's an old Indian proverb, Everything that's not given is lost. So the quality of the perfection of wise energy or effort has a kind of expansiveness to it, a quality of opening or discovery that I believe is natural to us. It is our nature to seek, to explore, like the Buddha's vow, may I awaken in the midst of every circumstance, bring compassion, wakefulness, freedom, no matter what circumstance I am born into. All you have to do to understand it is look at a child. I mean, they spend their entire first years just experimenting and exploring how things taste, how they feel, what happens when you, you know, drop something on the ground. Oh, gravity works again, you know, and then they throw it off the high chair and it drops again. Oh, it's still working today, right? Let's try it again. Someone picks it up and throw it off another time. The whole of childhood is this incredible sense of wonder and discovery. What have we been born into? And that's us. That's our life. I mean, it's amazing to be a human being. Now, if we want to find a genuine freedom in this world and in spiritual practice, this quality of discovery also takes a kind of courage. As Don Juan said to Castaneda, only as a spiritual warrior can one withstand the path of knowledge. For a warrior, everything that comes is a challenge, while for an ordinary person, they see them either as a blessing or a curse. For a spiritual warrior, there are only challenges, and challenges cannot possibly be good or bad. Challenges are simply challenges. So, in the simplest way, in meditation, we sit and we're asked to open to pleasure and pain and joy and sorrow and grief and longing and love, to all that arises. And it's not secure. It's not so easy. To find that capacity for presence in the midst of all things. One Zen master I know, his main instruction to students was, cut all your bargaining. Just get with the program. And a friend who was in Bodh Gaya, who did the Tibetan Nundro practice of 100,000 full body prostrations and mantra offerings and mandala offerings and so forth, she had been ill and also quite disturbed inwardly. She had a number of years of kind of great mental disturbance, and she went to this lama and he said, you do this practice, 100,000 of these, and it will center you. She went back to see him, said that it helped someone. He said, that's good. She said, I've done everything you asked. He said, well, now that you've done it once, try it a few more times. She ended up spending 3 or 4 years just doing that simple bowing. And I saw her after that, and it was wonderful to see. She was so present in her body and in her being. Deep spiritual practice takes a kind of courage. Often there's an initiation or initiatory quality to it. The Tibetan story is of a man who went to see this great Tibetan teacher or lama and asked for the teachings. And the teacher said, I'm not going to give you the teachings. I, you know, spent years practicing and studying, getting this. I don't give these away easily. He said, I want gold. Bring me a pile of gold, more gold than I can hold in my two hands, of dust of gold. He picked up the sand where he was sitting. I want like this sand, I want it all gold. So the man went out and he worked and he slaved and he did everything he could. And after some years he came back to the teacher and prostrated himself and said, I really want the teachings and here it is. And he took out his bag. Here's the handfuls of gold. Put it into the teacher's hand. The teacher said, gold, you brought it. And then he threw it to the wind and said, thank you. Now you're ready to start. In Zen, there's a practice called Tangaryo, which is the way that one enters the monastery. If you want to go and practice in Japan, before you are taken into the monastery for training, you have to sit outside the gates and show your earnestness and your sincerity by sitting, and as long as you can, basically sitting all day and not moving. You know, you might have to get up and move once and then sit back down again. Oftentimes, even in the winter, in the snow, you know, there's the demons at the gates, and you have to prove your worthiness to go through the demons. So you sit for 2, 3, or 4 days in there, out there in the snow. And after a while, the Zen monks inside kind of look out, and they say, well, we got another one out there. Yeah, let's see how long they last, and kind of peek out for a while. And you just sit and sit and sit. And after 3 or 4 days or whatever, the gates open, and someone says, oh, we notice you've been sitting out here. Have you come for something? And you say, yes, I've come for training. And they say, please come in, let's have a conversation. This is the part of effort or energy or willingness that's about courage. As much as there's that presence to be here with a fullness of heart, for a lot of people in this culture, it requires a kind of initiation. Especially for our kids, you know, we've lost rites of passage. And then kids in the ghettos or the inner cities and so forth do it themselves because there are no elders, through gangs or guns or drugs or whatever. I mean, kids love danger often. Robert Bly begins his book on Iron John, some description of this, by the young man coming in and saying, anything dangerous to do around here? It's kind of the question at a certain age. This book on initiation I've been reading. I wanted to be different, to find out who I was. So I became friends with the hanger-outers at high school. You know, the ones who dressed in black and hung out in the back of the parking lot and smoked dope a lot. We were really cool. That's why I became a death rocker. I bought all the right clothes, listened to the right music, dyed my hair black, wore makeup that made me look pale and almost invisible. What I find most interesting when I think back was my overwhelming desire not to depend on other people or cling to adults for strength. It took abusing myself, you know, and nearly dying before I could prove to myself that I could be who I was alone. So part of traditional spiritual training is to offer a context within which we can discover that kind of courage in ourselves. And in the end, spiritual life always contains a descent or a dark night or loss or the facing of grief or guilt or shame or death or our aloneness in some very, very difficult way. Because it's only through that that we find the fearlessness of the heart, that we step beyond the body, the small sense of fear, to something greater. Carl Fried von Durkheim puts this way, the person who is really on the way, falling upon hard times in the world, will not as a consequence turn to those friends who offer them refuge and comfort and encourage their old self to survive. Rather, they will seek out someone who faithfully and inexorably helps them to risk themselves so that they may endure the difficulty and pass courageously through it. Only to the extent that a person exposes themselves over and over again to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found within them. In this daring lies dignity and the spirit of true awakening. What we give our love and energy to willingly and consciously, even though difficult, is what allows us to grow. Acting with a full heart, presence. So a great quality of this perfection of effort or energy is the willingness to be present. But with it, another aspect is that quality of balance and steadiness. We live in such crazy times that sometimes people think the right effort is to just do more and more and more and more. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything, is to succumb to the violence of our times. That's Thomas Merton. There's a natural knowing in the heart about wise energy or wise effort. The image from the Buddha is the tuning of the strings of a lute or a guitar, not too tight and not too loose, but finding that place that's balanced within our bodies, within our hearts and minds. It is the capacity to stay present and balanced. Rudyard Kipling said, "If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, you will discover the secret." The impostors of triumph and the impostors of disaster. Because they're just part of the script in the theater and the play. At first, in my own spiritual practice, and when I think back to the early years in monastery in my, you know, early 20s, I did it in a much more kind of warrior-like way. I sit all night and not move. And that was part of the ascetic practices in the monastery. And sit out in the forest with burning corpses in the charnel grounds and, you know, walk 10 miles each way barefoot and get your bowl of food each day. And the young monks would kind of try and outdo one another, you know, and stuff. There was that kind of macho monk thing or something like that. Right? And some of it worked, you know, if you sit and you don't move and there's all the pain and whatever, and you just, there's a kind of incredible steadiness to just not be moved by anything. After time, all kinds of extraordinary states and experiences will open. A lot of struggle with it, and finally you kind of transcend that. But after a while, I mean, it was okay to do as a young man. It began to be kind of painful to try and go back and do that and repeat that over again. First, my body didn't like it a lot. A 50-year-old body doesn't like it in the same way. But secondly, it didn't feel balanced at all. It wasn't really the practice of awakening in the long run. And I began to understand the meaning of balance. The perfection of this wise effort is not just the warrior side that Castaneda spoke of, but it also has a kind of nourishment or the strength of the feminine side, if you will. It's like the Buddha who tried all the ascetic practices of India until he was almost dead and realized that that didn't work and finally was given this bowl of milk rice, which is really the symbol of nourishment of the feminine, and took that in and realized, I've been going the wrong way. I need to find the middle path. And that middle path is a steadiness and a presence without struggle, with a kind of an openness and balance. And that's the strength, you might say, of the mother, where love is like a millstone that just grinds everything again and again, very steadily. It's the quality of being in labor for lots and lots of hours, or raising children, you know, and putting the spoon in and then the food gets spit out and you scoop it up and stick it in the mouth again over and over again, or the child falls or throws the thing over the edge and you pick it up and give it to them, and you do it over and over and over again. And you know, how many diapers do you change? Not just for mothers, but fathers as well. You know, how many fevers do you sit up all night with your children and so forth? There's a steadiness and a kindness and a willingness just to do it over and over again, because the effort is to be present itself. This moment, can we be here? Can we be awake? the deepest aspect of this conscious energy or vitality of our Buddha nature is its inherent presence in our lives. It is what moves the stars and what gave birth to you and me. And there are many, many ways that we've been cut off from our energy and closed down from the art teachers who said to you in third grade, that doesn't look like a horse, you know, don't draw that. Or the music teachers that say, mouth the words, you know, because you're not singing it right. It's true. Remember those kind of teachers? You know, and the kind of shaming and survival that we've had to go through and fear and, you know, the struggles that we've had. Maybe it's just taking enough multiple choice tests and you lose your creative impulse somewhere along the line, filling in C's and B's and D's and A's. It's pretty painful, actually. And so part of the discovery of the perfection of energy is a reclaiming of our body and its joy and movement, and a reclaiming of the full range of our heart of grief and love and excitement, and the reclaiming of the spirit. You remember the story of James McNeill Whistler, the painter who went to West Point Military Academy in the 1860s, and the engineering class, he had instructions to draw a picture of a bridge as a military exercise. So he painted this beautiful stone bridge and put two kids on it fishing from the top of the bridge. You know, and the lieutenant who was running the class or whatever said, this is a military exercise, get those kids off the bridge. So he redid it. There were the two kids, but now they were fishing from the side of the stream, right? And the lieutenant got even angry, and he said, listen, this is a military exercise. I said, get those children completely out of the picture. Draw me another bridge. So he did this stone bridge again. No children. And on the stream bank, there were two tiny little gravestones just by the edge of the river. And then Whistler quit after that. And it took him a while to reclaim that energy that was the life energy that wanted to paint and dance and sing and be alive in all circumstances. So that is our Buddha nature. That is the place. From Pablo Casals. He says, when will we teach our children what they are? One should be able to say to them, do you know what you are? You are a marvel. You are unique. In all the world, there is no other child exactly like you. No other adult either. In the millions of years that have passed, there has never been another child like you. One looks at your body. What a wonder it is. Your legs, your arms, your creative and cunning fingers, the way you move. You may become a Shakespeare, a Michelangelo, a Beethoven. You have the capacity for anything. Yes, you are a marvel, and when you grow up, can you harm another who is like you, also a marvel? So that's part of this spirit of Buddha nature, seeing the beauty in our own life and giving it expression, to reclaim our feelings, our body, our mind, to value this aliveness, and allow it to move us. And when we discover this kind of energy, which you might also call the energy of love, there comes a willingness or a fearlessness, I don't know quite what the word to call it, to enter life, and an ease as well. The Taoists call it free and easy wandering, to dance on mountaintops and in graveyards the same. And like the seasons then, within us we know the time for rest and the time for action, the time for stillness and the time to serve. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. There is a natural joy that comes in following our rhythms and seasons. And when we pay attention, then this kind of spiritual freedom begins to grow in us unbounded, easily. The image from the Buddha is entering each moment like the elephant that moves through the rushes, unstoppable. There's the grasses, and the elephant just wanders as it will. Nothing really in the way. We breathe in and breathe out and take this moment and respond to it. The wise men and women of old of the Tao had no mind to fight the Tao. They did not, by their own contrivance, try to help the Tao along. Wasn't some way that we're supposed to be, but really a moving with the flow of life itself. There's a strength and a flexibility and an ease and a graciousness. All of these qualities that come with this presence. One more story for you. A few years ago at the Seattle Special Olympics, 9 contestants, all physically or mentally disabled, assembled at the starting line for the 100-yard dash. As the gun went off, they all started out, not exactly in a dash, but with the relish to run the race and finish it and win. All that is, except for one boy who stumbled on the asphalt, tumbled a couple of times, and began to cry. The other 8 heard the boy cry, so they slowed down and paused. Then they all turned around and went back, every one of them. One girl with Down syndrome bent down and kissed him and said, "This'll help make it better." Then all 9 of them linked arms and walked together to the finish line. And everyone in the stadium stood up and the cheering went on for 10 minutes. What will we do, you know, that really is of value in this world comes from this quality of presence in the midst of everything. So Teilhard de Chardin wrote, "Someday, after we have mastered the winds, the waves, the tides and gravity, we shall harness for the divine the energies or the power of love. And then, for the second time in the history of the world, we will have discovered fire." Let's sit for a little bit. And as you sit, let yourself reflect, what would the wise energy of a Buddha, the compassionate and wise energy of a Buddha, ask of you in your meditation? What would that be like? And perhaps in the same way to reflect in your life, what places are asking for this Buddha nature to show its courage and compassion and the wise energy that you have been given. Let yourself reflect and see.
This concludes part 4 of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with part 5.